so if you're using one of the Black Church Bibles, the reading's found on page 618. So it's Daniel 6, 1 to 20. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps are made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man Daniel unless it has something to do with the law of his God." So these administrators and satraps went as a group to the king and said, "May King Darius live forever." The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisers, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, your majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered, in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. So King Darius put the decree in writing. Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room, where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. Three times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. "Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human being except to you, your majesty, would be thrown into the lion's den?" The king answered, "The decree stands in accordance with the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." Then they said to the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day." When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Then the men went as a group to King Darius and said to him, "Remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed." So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?"
Thanks, Estelle. What a cliffhanger. Will you join with me in prayer? Heavenly Father, thank you so much for your promise that when your word goes out, it does not return empty and always achieves its purposes. Lord, I just pray that in the next half an hour or so that you will use a feeble, weak instrument like me to encourage my brothers and sisters here today, that they may be strengthened and be courageous. In Jesus' name, amen. Terry did mention that there are a few people that I do know around the congregation. I know him pretty much from FCG days when we were meeting back in Burwood Presbyterian Church. Of course, I know Francis. And Danny and other people who's sitting with you today. But I probably wager there's one thing that you guys none of you know, and that is that when I was really small, I was a fat kid. And not just a fat kid, but, yeah, you know Chong, not just a fat kid, and not just a chubby kid, but a really tubby kid. Yeah. And as a fat kid, I have this love-hate relationship with school recess. Because on one hand, recess was great because it meant that I could go to the canteen and buy myself a packet of Plenty Baked and kettle chips, which I loved. But I also hated recess because it meant that I had to play with other kids. And playtime with other kids was really fun. Because almost every game that they picked, the key to winning the game was either you run really fast or you were like really skinny. And obviously I had neither attributes. I hated tips. I hated hide and seek. I never really got why, you know, my school just planted trees which is just like this thin and couldn't hide the girth of my waist. But there was one game which I hated the most. One game that gives me chills every time I mention its name. One game which reminds me of how dark the human heart can be and how broken the world is. And that game is Piggy in the Middle. You know, the game where the kids organize themselves in a circle and a ball gets passed to one another while the piggy who's inside the circle tries to intercept the ball? Yeah, you guys know it. I hated that game because every time we played that game, somehow I got picked the piggy, always, and I stayed the piggy pretty much the whole game. It was humiliating. It was a cruel game only made worse by the fact that my school endorsed it. I still remember that time when I was around with other kids and happily licking the insides of my empty kettle chips packet. When out of the blue, the duty teacher passes the ball to the kid next to me. And before I could react, the other kids all looked at one another as if they all understood what game they would play, who would be in, and fanned out in a circle and yelled out, "Where's the piggy?" The teacher walked away, oblivious to the evil that she had wrought upon me. And I hopelessly flailed my fat arms, you know, to try and catch the ball and endured the ha-ha, can't catch the ball. I remember thinking to myself, I am oppressed by this gang of kids. I am oppressed by my school. This system is set up against fat people like me. Or words to that effect. Oppression comes in many forms. But the worst kind is when oppression comes not from one person, or from many people, but when it's all the above and more. The worst kind is when it feels like the whole system is set up against you. And as someone who's reached an age where I'm sending my own children to school, I realize that life throws at you that kind of whole of system intense oppression more than once. I know that for some, oppression of that kind stays with you a lifetime. It doesn't stop. It never ends. What I love about the Bible is that it's real and it speaks to real life. And so in our story, we see Daniel facing this kind of systematic oppression. But instead of humiliation, the stakes are life and death. So true to what God said will happen in Daniel chapter 5, as we heard last week, the Babylonians have been kicked out of office and the Medes are in power. The new king Darius set up three administrators, or kind of like deputy rulers, and Daniel is one of them. Under these three guys, 120 satraps, or high-ranking governors, are appointed to run his kingdom. And what we learn from verse 4 and 7 is that these administrators and satraps all want to get rid of Daniel. They're all in on a plan to kill him. Daniel is oppressed. not from one powerful king like in, you know, chapter 3 with his friends in the fiery furnace, but everyone in his workplace. Everyone, whether the same seniority or those under him. What a horrible environment to work in. Can you imagine being in that situation? As you walk into work, the front desk receptionist, the colleague sitting beside you on the floor, the guy who keeps going to the filter tap every 5 minutes, the group in the lunchroom, absolutely everyone wanting and scheming to get you fired. What a toxic environment to be in. And when you have so many people having a particular attitude about something, especially when they hold positions of authorities as satraps and administrators, that attitude becomes rooted in the system. It becomes part of the organization's culture. It's like when I started out at my last job and my team discovered that they all loved falafels. I don't like eating falafels, you know, they're dry, they look like deep-fried meatballs, but they're not deep-fried meatballs, and they don't serve anything with falafels that is meat, just the falafels. But when my boss and the rest of the team were jumping with excitement about doing a falafel run and said, "Hey, Wozdog, are you in?" You know what I said? Falafels! But instead of loving falafels, the culture of Daniel's workplace was to kill Daniel. Do you think even if one of the 122 satraps or administrators had a change of heart, they would stick their head out and say, "Hey, I don't think it's right that what we're doing to kill Daniel"? No. They're thinking, "I better toe the party line, or I'll be the one thrown with the lions with Daniel." What's more, no one has power to stop these guys, right? Not Daniel. Not even King Darius. And that's a big deal, because if there was one person in the whole kingdom who could do something about this, it would have been the king. After all, as we heard from Pastor Joe Mock, the king is running a dictatorship. It's meant to work like the king wants, the king gets. But rather, King Darius and his laws have been exploited by the administrators and satraps so that there's no way to rescue Daniel. The system that is in place has not only failed to rescue Daniel, but actually worked against him. Have you experienced this kind of oppression before? Oppression that isn't just one person or many people, but as if it's the whole system that's working against you? Maybe you've been studying a course where your university had sold you a lie. They promised you a glamorous degree, a glamorous career, a glamorous job in a glamorous industry. But now that you're in it, you're actually studying it, you realize it's far from glamorous. In fact, it's oversaturated, and it's impossible to get a job. By the time you finish your studies, you'll be sending out 100 job applications and be lucky to get one back. Sitting next to the people that you're sitting next to, your students, are as much as your fellow classmate as your competition and rival. It's not just your uni, your future employers, not even the people around you, but the whole industry that is working against you. Maybe it's the kind of oppression you feel being part of a family that doesn't love Jesus as you do. I know a guy is loving, patient, and kind. But whenever he was with his family, he was always made out to be the black sheep for doing too much ministry and giving too much money to church. All the time, his aging parents would make insensitive comments about how he used his time, and his siblings would say that he is irresponsible. And for him, it felt like he wasn't only against his parents, his siblings, but the whole value system of his family. And every minute he spent with them, their collective criticalness weighed heavily on their shoulders. Maybe you're like him. Or maybe it's your network of friends, right? Where when you're hanging with them, you're the butt of every joke that they have, and when you're not, the topic of gossip. You're part of their WhatsApp group, but not part of their other WhatsApp group that you're not in their WhatsApp group for. You feel crushed by their words and by the friendship culture in your group to poke fun at you and gossip about you. Sure, you're not being thrown into a den of lions, but sometimes it sure feels like life is being sucked out of you. When you're the victim of this kind of oppression, it's not only a question of how do you faithfully live as a Christian, but how do you wake up the next morning? How do you do anything? Maybe what you feel is best put into the words of David in his 22nd Psalm. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart has turned to wax. It has melted within me. My mouth is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs surround me. A pack of villains encircle me. They pierce my hands and my feet. Luckily, the story of Daniel and the lion's den doesn't end where the Bible reading stops. Estelle left us on a cliffhanger. So why don't you open your Bibles up and let's continue to read from verse 20. When he came near the den, King Darius called to Daniel in an anguished voice, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God whom you serve continually been able to rescue you from the lions? Daniel answered, May the king live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I done any wrong before you, your majesty. The king was overjoyed, and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him, because he had trusted in God. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den, along with their wives and children. And before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then King Darius wrote to all the nations and peoples of every language in all the earth, May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the earth and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. The good news is that the story of Daniel in the lion's den is a message for hope, for people under-oppressed. It's a story of hope. There are two sources of hope worth, fleshing out in this passage. The first is that God is able to save. God is able to save. Daniel gets thrown into the lion's den and God rescues him. Lions, right? Lions. Not kittens, not girls dressed in lion onesies, but real hungry lions that overpower and crushes the bones of their prey. To face lions is like facing, a convoy of semi-trailers on WestConnex. But God saves Daniel. God sends his angel to shut the jaws of the lions. And God does it in a way that even the king testifies that God is Daniel's deliverer. God is able to save Daniel, and he did. But it wasn't just the lions, right? God saved Daniel by removing the source of oppression rooted in the system of government, the 120 satraps and administrators. God's hand is over the decision of King Darius to execute the satraps and administrators, because no one expects a king to kill off all his governing officials all in one go, no matter what crimes they've committed. No CEO would fire all his senior executive staff all in one go. If he did, the company would be in chaos. But yet, the king, under God's sovereignty, does it here. And you know what? The empire probably was in shambles because of it. Now, about the king killing the women and children, it's not in the version that I read to my two-year-old at nighttime, for whatever reason. A few things that I need to say. I don't think that the Bible's here saying that it's a good and righteous thing for King Darius to do this. The Bible is very clear that God is a God of justice and stands for just punishment. But what is important to know is that God has removed the cancer in King Darius's kingdom completely. Not only are the conspiring satraps and administrators are all gone, there won't be any vengeful wife or child to plot evil against Daniel in the future. In the same way, God is able to rescue us from our oppression. Doesn't that make you want to go to him for help? Listen, if your friend invited you here to come and you're on a journey to find out more about this Christianity thing, you need to know this. If and when you're facing a time in your life where you feel oppressed and powerless, whether it's small or big, from someone or from a system, let me tell you, the God of the Bible has the power to rescue you in a way that no other God can. He is able to rescue you. He created the whole universe and sustains it, and not a moment in life happens which is beyond his control. He is able to save you. And that God is able to save is good news for us. But the better news is that the passage actually gives us more hope. And I imagine that actually for some of us, we actually do need more hope. Because when we are facing oppression and in the thick of it, it's only human to say after reading this story, all good for Daniel, but God hasn't rescued me. This is why the second source of hope is so important. The hope that God's kingdom is eternal. That God's kingdom is eternal. You can see this at verse 26 when Darius testifies that God's kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. Echoing, you know, similar verses in past chapters of the book. You also get this at the post-credit scene, you know, of the story, where we're told that Daniel prospered not only in the reign of the Medes, but as the next foreign rulers come in, the Persians, which emphasizes God's sovereignty in the now and in the future. You also see this when Daniel prays towards Jerusalem, the ruined capital city of God's kingdom. As one Bible commentator puts it, this is not Daniel being sentimental, but him fixating on what Jerusalem represents, which is God's promises about God restoring and bringing in an eternal kingdom like those found in Micah chapter 4. Knowing that God's kingdom is eternal gives us hope, because as Christians, we also have the privilege of knowing the full revelation of God's promises in the Old Testament about his kingdom. It's not just about establishing a political regime or an Israeli theocracy in a broken world. No, it's much better than that. It's the ushering of a new heavenly kingdom on earth which transforms the whole world so that suffering and oppression will not exist anymore. A time and place where God himself will dwell with us. In Revelation chapter 21, the Apostle John gives us the clearest snapshot of what that looks like. Let me read it for you. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he dwells with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things have passed away." What an amazing promise we have. God's kingdom is eternal, and it's a place where mourning, crying, and pain are no more. As Christians, we've been invited to be part of that place. As the Apostle Paul says in Colossians, God has delivered us from the dominion of darkness and transferred us into the kingdom of his beloved Son. And when you have such a wonderful place to look ahead, to be in for all eternity, it puts everything into perspective. Any oppression we experience, even if it were for a lifetime, in light of eternity, it's only going to feel momentary. The pain of oppression is going to feel like stepping on a Lego piece as you go out and hang out with your friends to watch the next Avengers movie. Or stubbing your toe as you head out on a date with your girlfriend. Or how another person I know puts it, like a bad night at a cheap hotel. Just like Daniel, who fixed his eyes on Jerusalem, how we are able to wake up every day and live faithfully as a Christian, even pray in the face of oppression, is to have our eyes fixed on the new Jerusalem that is to come. One last thought I'd like to leave with you. It's one thought about Jesus. Much like Daniel, right, Jesus was oppressed. He was oppressed by his co-workers, who he called his disciples. They betrayed him. He was oppressed by the mob of religious leaders who schemed to have him killed. He was oppressed by the Roman authorities whose administrators and laws failed to protect an innocent man like him. But unlike Daniel, he wasn't thrown into a den of lions, but into a crowd of murderers. Unlike Daniel, no angel came to save Jesus. Rather, the jaws of death overpowered Jesus and crushed his bones. Unlike Daniel, where no wounds were found on him, Jesus died with his hands and feet pierced to a cross. But this was done so that God might raise him from the dead and seat him at the center of the new Jerusalem. He was raised as the first fruit among us so that we may look to him and his kingdom and know that our oppression is only but momentary, and that we have an eternity to look forward where Jesus' glory is so radiant it would be as if night never existed.